Good evening and welcome to this late debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining me tonight I have Fianna Fáil TD for Kerry and spokesman on primary care and community health, John Brazel, Fine Gael Senator Martin Conway, Labour Senator Eoin O'Riordan, Independent Dublin City Councillor John Lyons and writer and broadcaster Lise Hand. Now we want to hear from you, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Now, the Irish Medical Organisation has been meeting this evening to decide on whether to ballot its consultant and non-consultant hospital doctor members for industrial action. We'll be hearing about that momentarily. But earlier today, Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin clashed with the Taoiseach on the government's response to hospital overcrowding.
The scale of the government's response, Taoiseach, is not where it should be in terms of the chronic issues that are facing the staff and the patients in emergency departments. It just simply isn't there. You need a fundamental reflection and rethink about how the government is approaching this crisis within our hospitals.
Thanks, Deputy. I don't mean any disrespect to you either, but your self-righteousness knows no limits. Let's not forget. I'll give you some facts. Let's not forget that you were Minister for Health once and you were famous for chiding Tallaght Hospital for not ordering enough trolleys when they were treating patients in the car park of Tallaght Hospital. And we don't even know how many people were on trolleys those days because you wouldn't count them. And also, you were a member of the government that took a decision, not for financial reasons, took a policy decision when you were in government to reduce the number of hospital beds. You started that during the boom, you continued it, and we reversed that decision in 2014 as soon as we had the money to do so. You should be off your high horse when it comes to this one.
Taoiseach Leo Varadkar there telling Micheál Martin to get off his high horse. Now, Anthony O'Connor, who is a consultant at Tallaght University Hospital and also a member of the IMO's Consultants Committee, has hot-footed it from that IMO meeting straight into our studio. What happened? What did you decide, Anthony?
We had an overwhelming endorsement to ballot for industrial action. It's not a decision that was taken lightly, but there was definitely a palpable anger and energy in the room that something has to be done about this problem and that the government will have to be forced, that their hand will have to be forced to do something about it.
So just what will this mean for patients? Because that's what people will be worried about tonight.
Well, what I hope it'll mean is that at some point over the next few weeks, the government will come back to us with proper concrete proposals so that we don't have to ever use this mandate that we're looking for and we can get back to doing what we actually want to be doing, which is looking after our patients in the numbers that we should be.
But when you say ballot for industry or to put that to the members, up to and including what are we talking about?
We would be keeping all options on the table, up to and including all out action. I don't see us, I mean that obviously is the nuclear option. Nobody wants to do that at all. There are a number of other things that can be done with industrial action, but certainly the temperature in the room there tonight was just one of exasperation and a real resolute sense that something has to be done and something has to be done now.
And this is specifically about the pay equality issue, is it? Because I know the IMO have a lot of gripes about a lot of issues in the health service, but this strike action ballot will be about pay equality?
Yes, over and above the cuts that were applied to the rest of the public service. There was another 30% cut visited on consultants only who were appointed after 2012 compared to those who were appointed before 2012. And that has landed us in a situation where we now have 500 vacant consultant posts. We never had vacant consultant posts in this country. We've got a situation now where the waiting lists have gone from about 350,000 back then to over 700,000 now. And a big part of the reason that 700,000 people are waiting on waiting lists is because we have a lost generation of doctors in this country who aren't coming back, who aren't providing the level of consultant delivered care that we want.
But the political difficulty, I suppose, for the government is that a lot of people will look at hospital consultants and say, you're paid quite a lot of money to begin with. Like, how much would new entrant start off on now?
It's in and around 120,000, and it is a good salary, but we have to be competitive. I came back from the UK and I took a pay cut to come back from the UK to here, in real terms and in terms of the currency back when sterling was worth something. But you know, nobody agrees this is a good idea. The Taoiseach came out in 2014 and said there should be pay equality. He was committed to pay equality. Then we had, you know, Tony O'Brien when he was head of the HSE saying this is a terrible mistake that has poisoned the well and caused a major problem for us. We had the public sector pay Commission reporting 18 months ago saying something has to be done about this. So as a union representative, I go into meetings with all these people and they sit across the table from me and they nod their heads and say, yeah, you're right, yeah, we agree something should be done, but nothing has happened. And it's now 7 years of failed policy. So we have to escalate it.
You had a meeting with the government recently, the IMO, not the Irish hospitals, just the IMO. What was put on the table for you at that meeting?
Nothing. There was some talk about reform. Now, the IMO has never been afraid of reform. I would say pound for pound in terms of the size of our membership, we've engaged in more reform than probably anybody in the public service. But there can be no reform until everybody's in the same level. There's no point in changing the conditions even more for new people.
Is the reform that the government want to talk to you about now basically based around the Donald de Butler report about taking private practice out of public hospitals?
The interesting thing about that is the first thing de Butler says is you have to sort out this problem. You have to get rid of this pay gap. So get rid of the pay gap and we will talk about reform till the cows come home. As I said, I could list off a litany of reforms we've been part of and agreed to down through the years. And we want to work like that. As the Butler says, you have to close the gap first.
Isn't this, though, a very dangerous strategy in terms of keeping the public on side? I mean, if we see the situation in hospitals tonight and the situation with waiting lists, particularly for elective procedures and all of that, this could, if it goes all the way and you do press take the nuclear option, it could greatly exacerbate that problem.
There is a potential for patients to be inconvenienced. I mean, there's no getting.
Well, I think beyond inconvenience, aren't we? Talking about very serious.
Well, I suppose if you look at, I spent 3 days out in the picket line with my nursing colleagues in January this year, and a responsible approach was taken to that industrial action, and the principles are laid down. And if we were to do that, and I really hope we don't, the door is open. We want the government to come to us with serious proposals, and let's do business. But if it did come to that, the same principles of doing everything possible to safeguard patient safety will apply. But we've got to get real here. Thousands of appointments are being cancelled because we don't have the doctors to see patients because we can't staff the hospitals. And it's not just affecting the hospitals in peripheral parts of the country, because now what's happening is patients are being referred from there into major urban centres and making the waiting list there far too long and denying care for everybody. We have to get this right. And we just can't spend another 5 years sitting across from people telling us they agree with us.
We've got a text in here. Irish hospital consultants are paid double the rate paid to German hospital consultants, that they're not happy, says Jim in Cork. I have another tweet here. The consultants were offered and accepted the terms of employment. So why now are they complaining? Is €300,000 not enough, public plus private? Because, of course, that is the scenario. I mean, most consultants have lucrative private practices.
There's two questions to take there. The first is about the German consultants. Now, how they register doctors in the continent is different in mainland Europe is different to how we register doctors here. So what they count as an average salary for a specialist encompasses trainees as well as fully trained consultants. When James Riley brought in this cut in 2012, he told us there would be plane loads of consultants coming over from Germany, Denmark and Holland. And guess what? They never arrived. So these sort of stats get trotted out every now and again. But, in the real world where I live and work, that doesn't apply. The second part was about private practice. I'm specifically saying here, this is 400 consultants who were appointed since 2012 who don't have private practice rights. So this is a
they're on the public only contracts.
They would be on A or B contracts. A is public only. B is private in a public hospital. But in reality, all that means is, like, let's say if I'm on call, 25 patients could come in. Maybe, five of them might have health insurance. They're classed as private patients. I do get a payment for that, but it's nothing. Yeah, it's certainly not an astronomical amount.
But I think most people think what they pay to their hospital consultants is fairly astronomical.
But what I'm talking about, this isn't for appointments. This is people who come into the hospital who happen to have insurance.
That you see.
And, they get them to sign the VHI form. I haven't a clue they're private until I get an email from the hospital 6 weeks later asking me to fill out a form so the hospital can get paid and I get a small amount of that.
Okay. Yeah. John, you want to get in there?
I do. I mean...
Would you support the IMO position?
I would, because this has been going on for so long and there has been such an amount of time from its initial debate that it'll be resolved to today and it's still not moving on. The de Butler report specifically says that pay equalisation has to be resolved. And if you just think about it practically, if you've got two patient people with the same qualifications doing the same job in the same hospital and one of them is paid 25% less than the other, then you're going to create lack of motivation, you're going to it will create equality issues.
There's a lot of teachers out there who will say that. Would you take the same stand?
At least the teacher situation is being resolved, and by 2021 you will have equalisation. And it started bit by bit and it's been too slow, but we're getting there. With this situation, it has remained the same. And down in Kerry, where, you know, where I represent, Kerry University Hospital finds it exceptionally difficult to recruit consultants. And this is one of the main issues. If you, how can you attract somebody to a job when there's somebody else doing the same job getting 25% more? So that issue has to be resolved. I mean, as Anthony said, if you were going to have people coming in from other countries, they would have been here by now. We need to, we 500 people to recruit. We need to recruit them, and you're not going to get them unless you resolve the pay issue, and then you can go about the changes that are needed in the De Butler report around public and private.
Okay, Aon O'Riordan, do you think this is a genuine claim that should be supported?
Well, look, instinctively, it's not easy to have instinctive, if you like, sympathy for somebody who starts off in 120 grand. But there is a principle at stake here, and I would agree with what has been said in terms of the principle that is at stake. The issue I have really is...
Sorry, do you support... Do you think there should be pay equalisation, that we should pay...
I do, but I don't want to take this case in isolation. I think there's a raft of public sector workers who deserve pay equalisation. And
the pay cut was delivered in isolation?
Yeah.
When you were in government?
No, I accept that. But the point I'm going to make is that... when we were in government...
How did Labour feel about this when this was introduced? Well, look,
I was just going to...
It was delivered in isolation because the consultants were better paid than all of the rest of the people who found themselves in a situation that were getting a pay cut. Yeah. So, it was an isolation for
a
very...
It was not a pay cut for any consultants. The public pay bill did not decrease by 1 cent.
Hang on a second, Anthony. I didn't interrupt you.
I just let Aon finish his point and we let Martin in.
In fairness, Mary, you didn't interrupt him, but you did interrupt me. I was just going to...
Yeah, but you're well used to interrupting me.
No, I suppose the point I was going to make is about the way that you handle industrial relations. In the round. And when we were in government, it was a particularly, as people remember, fraught time, no money, austerity, all the rest of it, and the country was wounded, and it was a difficult period. But we didn't have in any way the same amount of industrial relations disputes as we currently have under this administration. And I just have a list in front of me between...
But the reason for that was that people took on board the crisis.
Right,
surely
right.
That was part
on
of
the... premise,
the...
On the premise that when things improved, that... things would be restored. So just in the last number of years, I have a list just off the top of my head: Irish Rail, Dublin Bus, nurses, non-medical hospital staff, school secretaries, Section 39 workers, teachers also balloting. That's a lot of days being lost, a lot of industrial strife, a lot of hurt. Now, when somebody ballots for industrial action, there can be sometimes a feeling abroad that this is a small thing that a worker can do. It is a huge statement that a worker makes to potentially withdraw their labour because it is incredibly stressful for a household, regardless of their income, to go down this road. Now, my overall point is this, that Fine Gael are completely mishandling industrial relations. They don't really have a feel for it. And despite the fact that the economy has improved and there seems to be more money to spend in this area, we are losing more days and allowing more industrial disputes to bubble up. And it's a failure of management.
Martin Conway, what were you were going to say that... Look, you were standing over this the original decision.
Yeah,
here.
Look, the original decision was made in a time when this country was absolutely broke. We were in an IMF bailout, and those facts cannot be forgotten. And difficult decisions had to be made. Now,
seven years later.
Yeah, 7 years later, but we are facing Brexit as well. Don't forget that. But I will also say that I've often listened to Anthony, and I do find him to be reasonable in terms of his propositions and his positions and things. I regret the fact that the IMO have effectively threatened industrial action. I think that that's a renegade step. It's not necessary. I do believe that that these problems can and will be resolved by negotiations. I do accept the principle of pay equalisation, as does the government. And, we all want to get to a position where there is pay equalisation. And I agree with Aon.
Because you say that you accept the principle and if you talk to Anthony, who you say is a reasonable man, he tells us that when they went into their last talks, nothing was offered. There was nothing put on the table for pay equalisation.
I wasn't at the talks, but I don't accept that there was nothing put on the table, and I would challenge that proposition. But I actually agree with
Aon. What was put on the table?
As I said, I wasn't at the talks, but I agree with Aon. There is a lot of people on a lot less salaries salaries that need to have their pay equalisation dealt with just as quickly, if not more quickly, than hospital consultants. And I'll also want to point out that since 2009, we have seen an increase of hospital consultants from about 2,100 to an excess of 3,000. We've seen the number of hospital doctors, senior and junior, increase from 7,000 to 9,000. So there is more doctors being employed in the system throughout the recession, and there's more hospital consultants being employed throughout the recession.
Okay,
yes, there are issues, Katie.
Yeah, when I was it comes just going to say to you don't accept
there are issues with
about
the vacancies.
Recruitment and retention.
Yes, there are issues with vacancies. Absolutely, that's agreed. But the overall number has increased, and that is the facts.
But there are issues right across the health service, Martin. I mean, every metric.
But we all know that, John. There's no one disagreeing with that.
But I mean, in the last 9 years, every single metric you can look at regarding the health service has disimproved. That's factual.
Okay, Lise, I want to let the voices in. We haven't heard from you. Lise.
Yeah. Well, and then you John. Know, you could hear the you know, fractious nature of the exchanges in the Dáil between Micheál Martin and the Taoiseach today. And, you know, I suppose the irritation, open irritation displayed by Leo Varadkar just feeds into, because he knows that this is feeding into the wider narrative that of a broken health system. I mean, you've had, you know, in recent days, you've had the images of people sleeping on the floor in the psychiatric unit down in Waterford University Hospital. You know, it just seems to lurch from crisis to crisis. And it feeds into this sort of narrative that this, you know, everything is broken. I mean, you have another story today about St. Joseph's
the dementia care centre.
Right? Yeah. Dementia care centre. And I mean, I took a tour of that during the summer, and it's an absolutely wonderful facility. Mm. It's a model that should be rolled out. It should be something that the HSE is actually developing and rolling out, in, you know, across the country for badly needed, for badly needed cases of dementia. And you know, that feeds into the fact that there are so many hundreds of people, you know, that are locked into beds in hospitals because there's nowhere for step-down facilities, you know, so that doesn't free up beds. And, you know, the whole, it's an interlocking mess. Mm. And, you know, I think today...
But should pay equality for consultants be part of the solution? Should that be one of the first steps, as Anthony O'Connor would say there?
I think they have to look at it because, I mean, this government in particular live in fear of any, you know, of any kind of pay talks been put in front of them, because I think they regard it as whack-a-mole. You know, they sort of, you know, they sort out one, the next thing somebody else pops up and they've got to deal with that. And the finance minister is a great man for saying, you know, everything must hold and we have to hold hold the dam against, you know, a flood of requests and so on to keep the show on the road. But I think they just have to face up to this. It's not politically a popular one because, as you know, you rightly hear from your text messages.
I'm telling you, and I've got another whole raft, yeah. Anthony, of text messages pointing out exactly how much consultants pay compared to...
Yeah, it's not like the nurses on the picket line, instantly garner support because people are dealing with nurses every time they go into a hospital.
But by the way, when teachers...
Okay, no, sorry, I want to let John line in because he hasn't been in.
Well, just on it, the principle of pay equality is an important one, and I would support that. And the consultants have had a 30% reduction since 2012. But I do think there's a broader question in terms of the amount of money they are paid. It's quite incredible. The report from the Department of Public Expenditure cites 28% more than your UK counterparts, significantly more than most Northern European countries and comparable with Canada and the USA and slightly behind Australia. So I my motivation in terms of when you look at recruitment and retention as two of the issues raised in terms of saying that the level of pay is leading to problems in those two areas, I would question the motivation. Surely people who are trained to become doctors and they do go off and they specialise and some of them come back, I would hope that some element of public service would be involved in that, that they would actually feel...
Sorry, questioning my motivation. When I was all through my 20s, John, I worked 56 hours straight in emergency departments in this hospital, going in at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, leaving at 7 o'clock on a Monday night. How dare you or anybody question my motivation to public service?
In terms of the levels of pay... I don't think they're justified. You're a powerful lobby. You are very important. You're crucial to the health system. But I don't believe you are deserving of the levels of pay that you can... Actually, if you are public and private, you can get nearly €500,000.
You're entitled to that opinion.
And I just don't think that's justified.
You're absolutely entitled to that opinion.
System.
And that's okay. If you want
in
to
a public
a,
system, I don't
okay,
think that's
Okay, but if you want a system
justified.
Ongoing where we're spending €7 million a month on locums, where we've got 700,000 people on waiting lists because we can't
but
get
see, this
people
is
to
what
work
you, this is the threat.
That's fine.
This is your leverage.
It's not the threat, it's the reality.
This is the leverage.
abusing.
To be fair, consultants
John, I'm just going to ask you to
working in the service. It's not a threat. This is not something that might happen in the future, John. Mm-hmm. Open your eyes. It's what's happening on the ground at the moment. 700,000 people on waiting lists. That's not a threat, is it? Is that a threat? 7 million a month on the locum bill. Mm-hmm. Is that a threat? No, these are facts and they're verifiable. And to stand there sort of saying that these are threats and we're using patients as leverage, like, it's so insulting. I work so hard for my patients. I work 60, 70 hours a week. I've missed God knows how many family occasions and things. I love it. I love my job.
Anthony, many, many people in this economy work in similar circumstances.
And you're not questioning their professionalism and commitment and motivation.
But they don't receive three times the average industrial wage as their basic salary. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying you're paid too much. That's what I'm saying.
I think we need to pull this back. I certainly wouldn't want to be associated with anyone questioning the motivations of the fabulous consultants we have in this country. Yes, there are challenges when it comes to pay. Yes, there's a perception out there, correct or incorrect, that they're significantly well paid. But there is a problem, and you know the problem will be dealt with by government. But I certainly don't think that we need to be questioning anybody's motivations. Most people that I know in the medical profession are in it because they want to help people. And the fact is, the consultants in this country do save lives.
I just want to give you another flavour of what's coming in on our texts here. Well, an example of what you were saying there, Anthony. My husband waiting 2 years for an appointment for a cardiologist in Kerry. That's from Mary. It's not just the money. Consultants won't come back to the frustrations of an under-resourced service. I think, Anthony, you make that point as well. And then this one. Why can't pay equalisation for consultants involve both pay increases and decreases to find a happy medium?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. And the other thing that must be pointed out as well is that a lot of the consultants in this country who are trained at a significant cost to the taxpayer, which in other countries is a significant cost to their families. Because if you look at the states and other countries, families have to effectively get mortgages to send their children to medical school. Whereas in this country, if you haven't got the resources and you are bright enough to get the pints to go to medical school, the state will give you a grant. So there has to be a bit of appreciation as well in terms of what the state are doing to train and qualify doctors and consultants as well.
As it does for every other graduate, every other profession. And these numbers are thrown out
but
there.
But there's very few other professions paid the level you're paid, John, or Anthony.
My name's Anthony, There are plenty, and you guys made a deal with the judges and did all that very quietly, and there was no pushback against
it. The judges are paid nothing like hospital consultants. Not the colour of it. And they do not have a private practice.
Well, I think the issue as well is that I think, you know, a lot of the medical profession, when they qualify, decide to go abroad to work. You know, judges don't. I mean, judges qualify here, and you know, there's no great call for Irish judges in Australia or, you know, in the Far East. Whereas, you know, our medical, you know,
this is the problem, isn't it? That there is an international market for the well-educated, well-qualified consultants that we produce.
And I think they'd be more likely to come back if the system itself. I mean, you know, it's not. I think it's not just the pay issue. It's the fact that they come back and they're working, and all medical staff, nurses, all kind of all levels of people working in the health system, the hospital system, end up working, you know, long and insane hours
The previous government had a referendum to deal with judges' pay. I think that was a cheap shot.
If we agree that there should be pay equalisation for people on the pay scale that Anthony and his colleagues are on, well, then maybe we should agree that they don't deserve a tax cut.
Who don't deserve a tax cut?
People on that type of salary.
But sure, look at I suppose this is where I probably part company to a large extent. I don't believe in widespread tax cuts. I was delighted with the last budget where there wasn't widespread tax cuts. I've advocated within the Fine Gael parliamentary party to have a freeze on tax cuts until such time as we get issues like housing and health actually somewhat dealt with. Absolutely. I want to see tax cuts it's as good as anybody else. But I, in the first instance, want to see better public services. And you know, I will continue to fight that battle. Sometimes it can be a lonely battle, but I think it's a...
You're okay. Fianna Fáil are supporting you on that one, Mark.
I'll tell you something, George. We were able to go around.
We achieved a 3-to-1 ratio on the budget on public services.
The disappointing thing here is what we're listening to is really whatever sort of anti-consultant rhetoric or spoof suits a particular political position.
Or George Spoof.
Thrown out there. Yeah. Good man. Very clever. We've been sort of thrown out there, lobbed out there. And all the while, we have a crisis. The PS, Public Service Pay Commission, said we have a crisis. The HSE have said we've had a crisis. Even the Taoiseach, even your own party leader, the Taoiseach of the country, thinks this is a mistake. Cling to it if you want, Martin. And whatever political persuasion is leading people to cling to this position, that's fine. You've all got private health. A lot of you have private health insurance. You're not going to necessarily...
I presume you do as well, Anthony.
I do not, actually.
We'll take your word on it.
No, we won't. Sorry. Martin Conway, that's not...
You're talking
really
about cheap shots and below the belt.
Because you were the one that brought up private health insurance and who had it and who didn't have it.
Well, I think this is unedifying.
But it is. But in fairness, Martin, because I mean, it is a key point that if people who are making the policy decisions are never going to be exposed to some of the outcome of those policy decisions because they will never be at the back of the queue. Is there not an issue about the fact that most people, I would imagine, in Leinster House have their own private health insurance?
I have. All my political life advocated for universal healthcare. All my political life advocated for universal healthcare. And it's actually quite rich to be lectured by a consultant on that when they haven't a clue what I've advocated for.
Okay, let me just give you a flavour of more of the text coming in. Katie, my daughter, who is one of the top consultants in the world in her speciality, recently left the public hospital service and went totally private because of pay inequality, a terrible loss to public patients, says John. Somebody having a go at you. Aon, I'm not a bit surprised that the Labour Party will support hospital consultants' demands for salaries of 200,000, yet they have no hesitation in cutting social welfare payments when they were in government. And another one, you were making the point about the expensively educated
I'm going to challenge that, but anyway, I'll let you continue.
One where a lot of newly qualified doctors have huge student loans, which they must start repaying as soon as they receive their first paycheck. They don't even qualify for tax relief on this, which is totally cynical on the government's part. This is why the anomaly is so destructive and is a major cause of the hemorrhage of Irish doctors moving abroad, so says Michael O'Sullivan from Carrigaline. And on and on. I have to say, just looking at what I'm reading here in front of me, Anthony, a lot of people are balking at the notion of paying hospital consultants more than they're already being paid.
That's not the issue. The issue is that you've got a group of 400 people who aren't being, and it's causing a problem with recruitment going forward. These are the real worlds, and we can have consultants as the bogeymen and have all our shibboleths about education and all of these things. But in actual fact, we have a recruitment and retention crisis. Everybody agrees that something has to be done about it, and there's no will to do anything about it. And people just seem to be happy to poodle along, throwing out whatever line suits on any particular occasion. But, you know, unless we're going to do anything about it, there's going to be a problem.
But genuinely, like the reason why I raised the issue of motivation is not 120,000, as you say, is the basic. Is that not sufficient? Is that not enough to be well regarded within your profession as a consultant?
I came back and took this contract, but the problem is I have to do the job of two people because we can't attract anybody to work alongside me. And these are the issues. We've got 1.5 consultants per 100,000 population. The EU average is about 3.2. So you need more people like me. And question my motivations all you want, or I think you call
it's
me...
It's not about you. It's not about...
You question my motivations. He called me a disgrace. Yes, so I kind of think it is being personalised a little bit here, and I do think I have the right...
I actually defended your motivation.
One question I would have for my colleague to the left here is when James Riley did flippantly say that there'd be plenty of people coming over, consultants from the Netherlands and other Northern European countries, I think a targeted recruitment drive to consultants in those countries who are paid significantly less to do the same job wouldn't be a bad idea to be pursued.
But Anthony, you're saying there's just no likelihood
all these jobs are advertised in all the medical journals in Europe. They know about the jobs. There was a Spanish guy who came once who lasted for 3 days, I think, when he looked at the
school. We cannot.
We do. We work in a different way.
If there are people, young people, who leave college and they decide they want to go to Australia for lifestyle reasons or whatever, we cannot really stop them from doing that. But what we have to try and do is encourage them as best we can to come back to Ireland for not just financial reasons, but for, I suppose, lifestyle and family reasons as well.
And based
on the fact, Katie, that we spend an absolute fortune as a nation educating and training and giving them their qualifications, I think there has to be some sort of balance. I don't know how that's achieved, but there's going to have to be some sort of a discussion in terms of trying to achieve that.
Martin, sorry, you don't give a student their education. They earn it. They go out and they study and they get there. I mean, in
John,
fairness now,
students are
out there struggling to get through college. It's their effort that gets them their qualifications. Please don't say that this country gives them their education. They get it for themselves.
If somebody is struggling in college financially, they get a grant. That's the reality. It doesn't happen in other countries.
Martin,
you go to the United States. Does that happen?
Will in no way.
Does it happen in the United States?
Meet the cost they have going through college. The majority of students going through college will finish up with amount of loans or debt when they qualify, and if they don't, it's paid for by those who support them. There is no such thing as free education.
I'm making a point. You picked up on one element of my phraseology, which, you know,
people are
good at doing that. But the global point I'm making is that this country has a very, very good education system, which costs a lot of money. A lot of consultants and doctors are trained in this country and they go abroad, and we have to try and create some sort of an equilibrium where we encourage them to come back. It's a very simple point. It's
fix the
point,
the system
that's the
and
point
come back.
I've made.
Fix the health system. Yeah.
Would you
well,
be proposing
you were in government
seem,
for 15 years, John.
You seem very precious about you any criticism. Yeah. I mean, try
you're,
and keep,
you
try
were
and keep
in, you
the
were
debate
in government,
at
John,
a small
you were,
higher level of
you
personal
were,
okay,
language.
Please,
you were in
this is really not...
I'm the third person you've had to go off
hang on a second now. This is four against one. This is four against one. And I'm well able to defend myself, John, and you should know that.
Okay. You know what? Let's take a break there, and take a breather. I think we could all do with it. But stay with us because we want to discuss the O'Devany Gardens development after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back to Late Debate. In studio, we have Fianna Fáil's John Brazel, Fine Gael's Martin Conway, Labour's Éan O'Riordan, Independent City Councillor John Lyons, and writer and broadcaster Lise Hand. Anthony O'Connor has departed our studio because we're moving on to discuss the latest O'Devany Gardens development in every way. Because a number of councillors had to get a Garda escort out of Dublin City Hall on Monday evening after protesters confronted them about a vote to approve plans for the redevelopment of O'Devany Gardens. The developer Bartra Capital has been contracted to build 768 apartments and houses on the site. And of course, this development has been at the centre of a long-running battle over the council's plans to work with private developers to build housing on public land. John Lyons, you voted against this plan.
I did indeed, yes. And I voted against it in its former iteration back in 2017, excuse me, and 2016. And unfortunately, not enough of my colleagues on the City Council could see how bad a deal this was. It's been from the very first meeting that we had in 2015 in February, where the City Council said we're in a housing crisis, we need to look at what assets we have and how we can maximise those assets, leverage them to get some return of social housing. So the idea was to put up these sites, valuable sites, Oscar Traynor Road site in my area, O'Devany and St Michael's in Inchicore, and to see if the market was interested in developing these sites. At the whole way through, Katie, the full 4 years, we given no information, even up until Monday, we couldn't see any of the tender documents in terms of the costings, what Bartra, and it seems as if the developer is the ones that are setting the market prices, the value of the homes that are going to be built in that size, and hence the discount from there is still going to be a healthy profit for Barter. So unfortunately, the fig leaf that the Social Democrats, Labour, Greens and Fianna Fáil came up with on Monday was to say that they had a private meeting with the developer who had agreed to be open to the idea of selling 30% of the 50% of the units that they were going to sell in the open market, selling them to an approved housing body that has not yet been confirmed if an approved housing body is interested, and how they will raise the finances. So when you really go into the deal,
the approved housing body would then rent them out at cost rental.
And again, which will mean another subsidy, rather than doing what we're actually doing with St. Michael's, which is a cost rental and social housing model, which is to build the houses and to rent them. The rent would be linked to the cost, the construction of the houses and apartments, and it would be an affordable rent. So unfortunately, what's happened on Monday is that the very idea and implementation of public housing on public land, and this is related to the Land Development Agency, because the same model is going to be pursued, which is that all state lands will be given up to private interest developers who ultimately will seek to make at least a 15% profit margin on these developments. All state lands are going to be developed in such a fashion, which we'll see about 50% on the open market, essentially privatised, perhaps 20% affordable purchase and 30% social, or vice versa. So either way you look at it, it's a bad deal for the taxpayer, and it most certainly, and I genuinely thought my colleagues in the council could see how bad this was, and were feeling the pressure, not only from the protesters on the night who did disrupt, and I welcome the disruption, the meeting, but also the hundreds of people who emailed over the last couple of months in particular, I mean begging the City Council not to gift prime public land to a private developer. Land is finite. Once that decision is made, it's done.
It's gone.
And unfortunately, it's done.
But presumably there were people emailing as well saying, look, just let's get on with it. One way or another, we need those apartments. Mm. We need housing there.
Very few. And that was the argument that was made against some of us who were trying to come up with a better proposal, a public housing on public land led by the local authority type of proposal, is that you're not interested in delivering housing. You're delaying housing. But in fact, it would have been much quicker to proceed down that route, because when you go into this kind of a public procurement process, it's taken an enormous amount of time. Mm-hmm. Oscar Traynor has been delayed because they only have one team to actually develop each particular tender. So actually, if it had been done in-house with funding from national government and the European Investment Bank, and we had our own architects, and we contracted a builder to come on site and build those houses and apartments that are so badly needed, we would have had them development inside a lot cheaper as well.
Okay, I want to go to Eoin O'Riordan, because Labour were accused of selling out and all sorts of other types of treacherous behaviour in relation to this.
Yeah, well, look, I don't question John's motivations for how he voted the way
he
did.
Let's have no more questioning of motivation in the studio.
You can question away, I don't mind.
I don't think necessarily people should question the motives of what Labour, the Sock Dems, the Greens or Fianna Fáil did on Monday night either. I got elected to the North Inner City 15 years ago. And 15 years ago, in 2004, Debney Gardens was a live issue, and there was a plan to rejuvenate the Debney Gardens, and that fell asunder because of the McNamara issue and all the rest, and the crash came. And then 15 years after that, now I don't represent the area and I'm not on the City Council, but there's a tendency sometimes in politics to make the perfect the enemy of the good or of progress. Now, the previous deal that was on the table a number of months ago wasn't acceptable, because it did align with a lot of what John's saying here, but a private developer benefiting from a situation which was disproportionate. The new deal has been described as an ugly deal by Marie Sherlock, who voted for it, one of our Labour councillors in the City Council, because it gets more than what the previous deal offered, and also has a level of social and affordable housing within it, and affordable rental. And also it gets, to complete the point, it also gets the thing moving. And I think 15 years after the first discussions about rejuvenation of the Debney Gardens, there has to come a stage where the thing is actually begins to move and a decision is actually
But are you actually saying
made.
That you were just ground down to the point where you had to accept the burden?
I don't accept that. There comes a stage where a decision has to be made, and if you're in politics, you want to achieve something. If you're waiting for the perfect, you're going to be waiting a long time. And meanwhile, the site's going to be as it currently is, or has, as it has been for the last 15 years. So a proposal was made. it was rejected, the proposal was improved, and that improvement was accepted. And I think now we have a deal which has been described as ugly, but politics isn't perfect, life isn't perfect, but sometimes you get 70% of what you want is better than nothing.
But is there... that's okay for in this case, that's your position on this case, but roll it out beyond O'Devany Gardens, and we're hearing about 20 parcels of industrial land are going to be rezoned, and we know that the Land Development Agency is going to be handling a lot of these deeds. Is this going to be the model now, and is affordability going to be set by developers?
I know that our position as a party is that you want to build state housing on state land. The issue with the government is that they've placed pretty much all the initiative in the hands of private developers. That's from the Strategic Housing Development Act to height restrictions going, on board Pernola making decisions that nobody would ever have thought before. John and I would know about the Chivers site, which is really raising a huge amount of eyebrows about how that happened. The housing needs to be built, and there's going to have to be sites that are going to be developed. However, the ideal is that the city council has the power and the muscle and the resources to do that on land that they acquire or they own. But this particular site of Devaney, this has gone back, as I say, it's gone down 20 years, or 15, 20 years. There is a particular history with this particular site. And I think this kind of stands alone as getting a deal done that we can move it forward, because it has been let down and that community has been let down on previous plans so often in the past.
Katie, there is a legal point just to mention.
Very quickly, John, because I want
because
to get Martin in.
The improved offer that Aon refers to wasn't actually the report we were given by the housing manager, Brendan Kenny, was the same one that we were given last month. There was an addendum attached, which isn't, they say, material change to the actual report. It's just a separate letter conducted by that group, the Dublin Agreement parties, who actually said they were for public housing and public land and break that promise within 4 months. So there is, and Owen Keegan confirmed to me after the meeting, that there is doubt as to the actual legal effect of that agreement that they had with the developer, and that the possibility that that could actually undermine the procurement process, and that other people who tended for that particular development
could now
may
come
have
back
an issue
in and
on
say,
it.
Okay, sorry, well, Martin Connolly. Is Fine Gael for public housing or public land?
Of course, Fine Gael are for housing and to build housing. And the one way of resolving the absolute crisis, particularly in the city of Dublin, but it does percolate throughout the country, is actually by building houses. And there is a position here, and I think Aon articulated it very well. Like, you know, there isn't a perfect solution. You know, what is imperfect, if it's not let happen, and if it's continued to be bogged down in disagreement and delays, well, we're looking at a situation where the bones of 1,000 units won't be built in the O'Devany Garden.
But it's what somebody would say, like, and what good is units being built if they're completely unaffordable? And if the affordable purchase price here is going to be 310,000 for buying, and affordable rent is going to be somewhere, we don't know actually,
we're being told
maybe 1,300 a month.
Surely
we should be having a massive debate about what affordability is.
I absolutely agree, Katie. And yes, it's a fair point, and I accept the point. I am a firm believer that we need to have significantly escalate the building of houses. And I was listening this morning on Morning Ireland to the former Secretary General of the Department of Finance, John Moran, criticising local authorities for not drawing down the available money that's there, the lack of ambition within local authorities in terms of scaling up the building of houses is actually frightening. And I raised it in the Senate today because I think he's right. To be fair to Minister Murphy and the government, they have made available billions of euros to local authorities to build houses, but the money isn't being applied for. So there's a problem somewhere, and we need to get to the root of that problem. Why are some local authorities building houses and with ambitious targets, and others are not? We need to uniformalise this, and we need to actually escalate it. And the local authority CEOs have questions to answer, as far as I'm concerned, as to why it's not happening.
John Brazel, would you agree with that?
I wouldn't, because every experience I've had with trying to get social or housing built in when I was in Kerry County Council, it was always issues at the department, and the department will blame local authority will blame the department, and it goes around in a vicious circle. I mean, the bottom line for me in this is there is an absolute definite need to build approximately 30,000 houses per year for the next number of years to get back to level terms where we are to meet our housing needs. We've 10,000 people homeless. We've hundreds of thousands on the housing.
But are we having the wrong conversation? We're talking about building without talking about building affordable, because surely that, and if we have changed our definition, affordable,
we have
to my understanding, used to be cost build.
Yeah, yes.
And now it's a discount of 20% on a market value that is being set by the developer.
Has put down a significant proposal for an affordable housing, a complete affordable housing scheme that would, particularly in the larger cities where people who are on good incomes can afford to buy their own house. That is something that can be done on state land. But there is a need to mix. You need social housing, you need housing associations, you need affordable houses, and you need the private sector. You need to mix of the whole lot to build the number of houses up to about 30,000 per year for the next 4 or 5 years. And when you get that level coming into the market, the issues around affordability will stabilise because the supply issue will have been resolved.
Lise, just another. We're getting texts in and there's a few on this line. State land should not be given to private development, period. That's from Con Foley.
Well, that's probably, I would imagine, the prevailing mood is that the state is there. The state is, you know, it's part of the state's brief is to, you know, to build state house, build housing for people. There are 10,000 that are literally have no home. But not, you know, the issue isn't, it's just a lack of will. The amount, you know, to actually tackle the problem. I mean, the amount of schemes and plans that have run out of steam or run into brick walls or got entangled with red tape. You know, we a few years ago we had the, you know, living above the shop scheme, which has had many attempts to kind of get off the ground, and it keeps getting mired in regulations and, you know, fire regulations. And, you know, instead of a bit of creative thinking, we would apply to something like that. I mean, I think it was Father Peter McVerry, I think he estimated there was something like 5,000 to 8,000 vacant premises above shops. You know, I mean, and like, you know, and yet there is literally no political will to sort of say, okay, here's something that actually could be sorted out just by, you know, changing regulations, unique permits, you know, and this is the sort of thing that infuriates people. You know, they can't hear the words affordable housing without hearing the words developer or vulture fund as well. You know, you get people saying, well, okay, say if there's, you know, affordable housing is put up, what's to stop a vulture fund coming in and buying, you know, 30 or 40% of them? And, you know, then we're back to the races about, you know, people losing control of the, you know, of the deal, which is essentially on public land. So again, it goes back to my old friend, the lack of joined up thinking. You know, there is no genuine will to look at all the elements of this plan, not just developing social affordable housing, but using stock that is already there and actually putting together some kind of plan that will have. I mean, there's no downside to it because it revitalizes the inner city. It puts roofs over people's heads in different forms of housing stock. But just there's Lise, no will seems to be there. It just runs into brick wall after brick wall after red tape.
Yeah. Lise has a point in terms of that, because obviously all the regulations and the improved building regulations are to avoid the pyrites of the future and the building defects of the future. But it's a vicious circle, because all of these requirements add on money. And I dealt with a case recently where a rebuilding Ireland loan, a person wanted to self-build it. And they'd save about 35,000 if they were able to self-build. And we did a survey. No local authority in the country has actually sanctioned a self-build for somebody on Rebuilding Ireland. So that's an extra 35,000 to 40,000 to a contractor in order to build it. So we probably do have to have a conversation. But at the same time, we don't want to see standards drop.
Okay. I just want, we've only a few minutes left and I have to take another break. But stay with us, because we will have time to chat about the all expenses after this.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And just before we hit the hour, I want to move to Fobgate and, of course, those recent revelations about the number of TDs who clock in but don't then participate in the all votes. And I think a lot of people were a bit surprised maybe to hear that TDs can claim between 9,000 and 34,000 euro if they are checked in, registered as arriving in Leinster House for 120 days a year. Now, we heard, I'm sure you were listening to your constituency colleague, Michael Healy-Ray, this morning telling us that he was completely accused in the wrong and explaining the speed at which he can get from Dublin to Sneem. Do you believe that there is any abuse of the FOB system, John?
I don't, Katie, but I at least I have no evidence of it. Mm. But
it would be easily done, though, wouldn't it?
Of course it would be. But the issue is that this report on RT during the week seems to link Dáil voting to expenses. And, like, it's not. There's a whole series of other things you do in the Dáil. It's not just voting, and, you know, our voting records are there for everybody to see. Now, you know, there was some of the figures for some of the TDs, and I was out canvassing with Lorraine Clifford Lee last night in Malahide, and this came up on a few of the doorsteps. And, you know, it was like we're
at... Love the way you slipped in Lorraine's name there. Go on.
Duncan Smith for Fringo.
Sorry, my apologies.
We got a great response. She was brilliant.
No, I want to make a general point that when you get at the doors, it's like that we're at something or we're up to something. And, you know, I've often been out here on a debate and there's a vote in the Dáil and I miss it. And I'm clocked into the Dáil that day. I missed a vote, and that's on my record. And it's as if I've done something wrong, and I haven't. You know, I mean, like, there is the system that you have. I didn't invent it. I certainly would ask questions about it, but you were requested to be present for 120 days, and you will get your full expense.
I have to say one thing in defense of John and Michael Healy-Rae, two people that I meet in Leinster House between 7:30 and 8:30. Most mornings is either Michael Healy-Rae or John Bradley.
Saying that the hardest working TDs. But
the fact that Michael Healy-Rae can actually say,
look, I came in and then I went down to Sneem and whatever. The fact that he didn't contravene or break any laws doesn't necessarily mean that it's still right. You know, because you know, there's sort of a wider issue here, and it's very simply that there is. I have been out on many canvases with many TDs over the years, and you're out on the canvas with a politician, and a constituent will come up and will say to them, and I've seen this time after time again across all parties and across all constituencies, what are you going to do for me if I vote you in? And this goes back to the perception that a TD is in Leinster House to fix things, to get money and to fix things. Not that I have never once in all my years canvassing ever hear a constituent come up and say, you know, what you feel about this piece of legislation, or would you actually push this particular, you know, legislative issue if I vote you in? That doesn't happen.
But I'd say so about
excuse me a second, no, just finish the point. Yeah. So, you know, vote gate and fob gate, and we really need to get something else to say instead of gate. Yeah. You know, there is a link there. You know, it is about what TDs do with their time. And there's no other business in the world that unvouched expenses, you know, still exists. I mean, you know, anybody will tell you that you have to, you know, literally account for every single sou down to the last staple, you know, in most companies. But, you know, it feeds into the public perception that, you know, what are the TDs doing up there? You know, are they just getting... I mean, there are people who genuinely think that they get paid to vote. I've come across this. Yeah. That people think that it is literally pay per vote. So again, you know, this lax system... feeds into sort of the public cynicism about, you know, what exactly TDs are doing when they're in the Dáil.
But they're paid to legislate, and they're meant to be there.
But they're not. I mean, that's not their priority. Yeah, but it's not their priority.
I know, but they're meant to be. There's a huge cynicism around this, because you're hearing now Ken Fox on Twitter is doing a lot of good work
on
this.
Yes, he has, and I'll refer people to Ken Fox on Twitter because it's quite incredible
some of the details coming out.
Indeed, I think some people would have their eyes opened by some. No, sorry, Martin, we are actually out of time. And I want to thank all of my panel. I want to thank my producer tonight, Brian Lally. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Harry Buckless was on sound. And now it's over to Cathal Murray on Late Date.